Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona. It's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by three fascinating guests. We're going to have a very interesting conversation. With me is Catherine Halpin, founder and CEO of The Halpin Companies. Welcome, Catherine.
Thanks, Adrian. It's so wonderful to be with you.
Wonderful to see you again. We don't get to see each other very often. I'm glad we have a chance to talk today.
Yes.
And Mel Sanderson and Tina Kosumi from the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you, Adrian.
We discovered before we walked in the room here that there's more in common than initially meets the eye. Catherine and Mel live in the same building, one floor above each other, and both garden on their patio decks. So that's going to be fun. There's more that connects us here in the Valley than is initially obvious. But Catherine, I'd like to start with you and have you talk to us a little bit about the work you do. Tell us about the Halpin Companies, how you got started, and how you serve folks.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Mississippi, and I went to work at a very early age in my dad's CPA firm. So I became a CPA, and I did everything a CPA could do, and I didn't like any of it, and I wasn't very good at any of it either. So in 1995, I was so frustrated that nobody ever talked about the people issues because I was a people issue. I was around peg in a square hole, trying to fit into a square hole. When I was supposed to be doing my analytical work, I was down the hall chatting with someone. So, and there were other people issues. So I formed my firm to help business leaders eliminate the distractions and the disruptions that the people issues cause. So I can fix all of those. And it's been so exciting. So it feels like I haven't worked in 24 years because it doesn't feel like work.
Now, when did you relocate here to the Valley? You're somewhat of a fixture in not just the business scene, but also in the community, in politics, and all that. What's the story of your journey here and how you and your wife established yourselves here?
When I was able to escape from Mississippi, I was a junior in college, and as far as I could get was Dallas. I didn't know anything beyond Dallas, and so that was pretty exciting. And that's where I met my wife, and I've been with her for 38 years. She's been with me for 37. And then in 1992, I was working for a big consulting firm out of Chicago, and they asked me to relocate to Phoenix. It totally freaked me out. It took me a week to even be able to tell Bonnie that they had wanted me to move. And she said, well, it's your career. We have to go. Her dad had moved twice for his career. But in Vicksburg, Mississippi, nobody ever left. It was hard enough for me to get to Dallas. So it was a big move to come here. And when we got here, we loved Phoenix. Of course, we got here in November. And so what's not to love? And we were so happy. We had been heavily involved in the AIDS crisis in Dallas. We were trying to be out lesbians in the Catholic Church in the early 1980s. We got a lot of brain damage from that. But we did make a lot of really good friends. So when we got here, we didn't know very many people. We only had a few friends in Phoenix. And it was so great to be able to relax. So it took us a long time to build a community. But we lived in Windsor Square for 17 years. That's how I met Kathy Sachs. That's how I met you. And so from those neighbors, and Connie Ingalina is how I know Mel and Tina. And I met Connie when she and I formed our businesses the same year. So I can't tell you exactly how that all came together, but we've just been, I'm passionate about many things. And if you work with me, you'll know that I'm passionate about many things.
Yes, and you're a polymath, and you're committed to not just businesses, but to humans flourishing in environment they're in. You wrote a book a while back called Alignment for Success, bringing out the best in yourself, your team, and your company. You also have an ebook, The Respond, Not React Playbook. What are some of the core ideas in these books? What is it that business leaders and business owners need to understand about the people dimension of their companies?
Well, thanks for asking that, Adrian. The book is only five small chapters. The first one is on the high cost of chaos and fear, because when you're driven by fear or chaos, you're not going to ever get the results that you want. And so it's just trying to ground people in the current reality of their own situations. And then chapter two and chapter three are on self-leadership. I say we can't be a leader to anybody else if we can't be a leader to ourselves first. Actually, I didn't say that. That's not original with me. Bill George, the former CEO of Medtronic, said that when he saw people fail, leaders fail, it was never because they failed to lead their people. It was always because they failed to lead themselves. So I have two whole chapters, one on mindset and one on your behaviors.
You know, I have to say, I think this is such an important topic for people, not just leaders. I mean, even as a parent, Jen and I have two young boys They're almost 5 and 7. And I've come to the realization that all parenting is self-parenting.
Right.
It really has to start with taking care of ourselves and healing our own wounds and the things we've brought forward into adulthood that we didn't realize were going to come out of.
But our four-year-old triggers.
In a shocking way.
In a shocking way.
I used to think that I was a really cool, relaxed, easygoing guy.
Right.
And then I had very energetic, brilliant, creative children. And rather than embracing that all the time, there are times when I discover things in myself I don't like.
Right.
And I'm having to engage in conversations to grow up as the grown-up.
Exactly.
Which, you know, it's a metaphor that's not in any way a metaphor. It's a very real, practical life situation. But the same thing happens at work.
Exactly.
And better humans make better leaders. But what processes and support structures are there to help people develop themselves?
Right. Well, that takes us to my ebook, The 9 Habits in the Respond, Not React Playbook. So my dad was a workaholic, so I became a workaholic. It's just so not good. I couldn't see the forest for the trees. I thought everything was urgent, and I was the best person to do everything. And so that led to a lot of lack of fulfillment, lack of success. And it took a toll on my health. When I was 32 years old, my health collapsed. And so I had to really look at things differently. And I put in a program of what I call rigorous self-care. That's kind of an oxymoron. But I try to be really disciplined and really faithful and continually fine-tune, figuring out what is it that I need so that I can bring my best self every day consistently.
One of the things I know we're going to talk about as we bring Mel and Tina into the conversation is the importance of mentoring, especially for women and other populations in the workforce that have not always had direct access to the seats of power and authority and decision-making and so on. Mentoring and the kind of direct human relationships that bring people up with you is so critical, and yet in many ways can be very lacking, even where it's needed most. Is this something you see playing out in companies and organizations, and what's to be done about it?
Oh, yes. Well, my friend, Dr. Lois Zachary, has written a dozen books on this topic of mentoring. It's so important. And I've found in the situations where I've been the mentor and the mentee, I've benefited. So people have to know that there's tremendous opportunity to grow and develop, even if you're the mentor.
As you look out into the landscape, you work with a lot of different companies and a lot of different industries and a lot of different places. You've spoken at events all over. You have chances to interact with lots of business leaders and rising stars who are not yet in a leadership role, but are leading in their way. What are some of the common themes about what makes a great leader?
Well, a great parent makes a great leader. If they have good parenting skills, if they have the patience to be there and be present, and if they have self-awareness, they know when they need to take a step back and take a step away from being a parent or being a leader. If they know what works for them and what doesn't work for them. Many, many people are in leadership roles and they cannot articulate that. And so then people that work for them are frustrated because they're always trying to guess. Does he want this or does he want that? So people need to be build their own emotional intelligence and their own self-awareness if they want to be in leadership roles or if they want to be effective as an individual contributor.
You expressed so nicely a few moments ago how much distraction and disruption results from people issues.
Yes.
And those people issues take a variety of forms.
Yes.
Whether it's toxic gossip or people feeling not appreciated and responding in a kind of passive-aggressive way by underperforming in order to get back at the people they feel don't really see their value, which creates a weird self-fulfilling prophecy, of course.
Right.
What's the solution? I mean, you touched on many things, but when you go into an organization, where do you begin?
Well, the first place I start is to help the leadership team celebrate the successes. It's human nature to push forward, to overcome a hurdle and then just push forward without any reflection, without any thought, without any celebration. And so I cause them to hit the pause button, and I train them to do this in every meeting, whether it's a one-on-one telephone conversation or it's 300 people. And I encourage associations. I do an awful lot of work with associations. I encourage them to start their big galas with acknowledging some random volunteers or their board meeting with acknowledging each other. Because when you hit the pause button, it helps people get their basic human need met, to feel valued and feel appreciated. And that need is just as great as food and safety and shelter for all of us. But guess what? We don't talk about this, so nobody knows they have that need. When people are irrational, it's usually because they're driven by an unmet need to be recognized. And then for a team, it helps you start to articulate the success factors. Well, how did that committee launch that level of success? And how could we operationalize that and make every committee use that same approach? Or how could we make every team? Or Bob has some special gifts in this area. How could we give Bob more of those kinds of projects and fewer of the others? And then for the whole organization, it helps you articulate what I call the success factors, which are closely aligned with the values. What are the values of the organization and what are the success factors and how can we train everyone in those?
There's an emerging conversation among thought leaders and authors and analysts, sociologists of the contemporary workplace that something is seriously broken. And that in 100 years of innovation that has touched every aspect of our lives, technology, healthcare, food systems, et cetera, the one thing that is exactly the same as it was in the 19th century is the modern organization.
Yes.
The bureaucratic, hierarchical structure that locks people into roles that almost pulls out the worst in them because it creates fiefdoms and unequal power relations and so on. It's almost overwhelming at some level to realize the magnitude of this problem, that the way we work is not a match for our aspirations. Mm-hmm. It's easy to talk a good talk about innovation and people. Mm-hmm. We had a great conversation in the studio a few weeks ago on diversity and inclusion. And one of our guests, Robin Reed, who is the CEO or president of the Black Chamber of Arizona, made a really important point, which is we often throw those words around together as if they're a pair automatically, diversity and inclusion, as if the one means the other. Mm-hmm. Robin's point, which I underline and repeat as often as I can because it's so insightful, is that diversity is the necessary precondition, and then you have to get to work on inclusion.
That's right.
Diversity doesn't mean inclusion.
That's right.
Diversity first, then inclusion.
That's right.
From your perspective, you've been here in the Valley a long time. You were recently listed in the Phoenix Business Journal as one of the longest standing LGBTQ-owned companies here in the Valley. You have a unique view on some of these conversations around diversity, around inclusion, around creating a world that works for everyone.
Yes.
How do you bring that perspective into the engagements you have?
Well, I try to focus on getting the right people in the right roles based on their strengths, because, see, nobody did that at the University of Southern Mississippi for me. And in the large CPA firms that I worked in a Big Eight accounting firm, there was no awareness that maybe we should tap Catherine on the shoulder and say, why don't we put you in our personnel department, is what we called it then, or why don't we put you in sales and marketing because you're such a people person? No awareness at all. So everybody's strengths are unique and enduring according to the Gallup people. And we have to figure out what those are through, and I have a variety of methods to do that. And then we have to help them align their strengths. We can take a C player and make them an A player overnight just by aligning their role with their strengths, taking away the things they're not good at.
The C player may not be a C player at everything. She may be
exactly
in a role where her actual gifts and strengths are not being utilized.
Right. And you talked about the toxic gossip. Well, that's one of the coping mechanisms that I used, was to gossip. I had some unmet needs that came out of working in my dad's CPA firm at such an early age and being such a key player in my own family. I really raised my three younger siblings because the parents were really not present. And when I was about 15, I developed an unmet need to get credit, because he wouldn't give me credit for what I did at the workplace. He didn't give me credit at home. So I started having a conversation in my head. And NIH did a study recently, and it shows that we all have about 50,000 conversations every day in our head. And they're all negative. And mine was, I think the world is divided into two kinds of people. People like Bonnie, my spouse, she has about 50,000 conversations every day in her head that go something like this. Oh, why did I say that? I'm such an idiot. That was so stupid. But no, Catherine's conversations, and I represent the other 50% of the world, my conversations go something like this. That guy's an idiot. And I started that with my dad. So then I took it into the CPA world. So it didn't matter if I was in tax, audit, or consulting. Didn't matter if I worked for a man or a woman. They would come into my cubicle or my office and they would say, we're going to do this project this way. I'd say completely inauthentically, oh, that's a great idea. You idiot. And they could feel that. just like a dog or a cat can feel who doesn't like the dogs and the cats in the room. People feel that, and they responded accordingly by giving me wonderful severance packages. In the 1980s, I was going to write a book about how to build your wealth through severance packages.
It's a fascinating revolutionary idea.
But the workplace is so toxic because people have these unmet needs and they are driven to be irrational.
As leaders who listen to this, maybe they run a department, maybe they own a small business and have a few folks on their team, they might be thinking to themselves, you know what, we've got those challenges here. I've got those challenges personally as a leader. That's a real enlightened leader, someone who recognizes how big the gap is between her practices and her aspirations, right? We all struggle to acknowledge the areas of opportunity.
In opportunity, right.
The polite way of saying
right.
Our gaps. So someone listening to this, here's what you're saying. Where do they turn? I'm obviously calling you and
of
reaching
course.
Out to have a conversation, but what kinds of support is available? How do they know if they're at a place where they need to bring in an expert consultant or advisor or coach who's going to help them through this?
Well, you have to weigh the cost and the benefits. What's the cost of having this toxic employee who's gossiping and or passive aggressive or not delivering on time or on budget? You have to weigh the cost of that versus the benefit of getting that fixed and tweaking that person's role. And it's not complicated. In one complimentary confidential consultation with me, we can move the needle.
It's fascinating that at some level, it's never that complicated. I mean, you can always part ways with the person. But in many cases, I think a lot of leaders, especially those who hired the people who are struggling, get their own egos caught up in this. They want to think of themselves as somebody who's good at leading or good at hiring or good at managing difficult people. And it perpetuates a situation that's not really good for anyone in the
right?
organization.
And it can go on for years, decades.
As you look forward to the coming months, there's a lot at stake. There's a lot at play. The businesses here in the Valley are growing faster. Many are moving here. The political environment is, of course, always somewhat frothy and distracting for people on all sides of that spectrum. What are the core issues that you're encouraging people to focus on? Where do they put their attention to not get pulled into their own toxic conversations from whatever point of view? What do they need to be focusing on?
Well, the three keys to self-leadership is where they need to focus. And those are so simple. One is getting your heart rate elevated regularly so you get more endorphins released in your brain and you can see more clearly and you can see the big picture and you have a more balanced perspective. One is getting in nature. And because something about getting in touch with the cycles of life helps you see, that's more difficult here in Phoenix in the summer when it's 107. And then the third one is to use my 9 habits. They're not rocket science, they're basic fundamental time management and life management habits. But when they're done consistently, you get white space on your calendar. And I'm pretty sure every listener today would enjoy more white space on their calendar to be able to take a step back and look at situations that they're facing in a more strategic and more proactive way. And then the key to all of my work, my secret sauce over the last 24 years, has been I have a very soft, easy way, given that I'm from Mississippi and all, of helping people see what role they played and how they could have played a better role and taking ownership with the poor performers and going to the poor performers and saying, I'm so sorry, Bob, that you haven't been more successful. I can see that I should have been meeting with you more frequently, or I can see that I should have been more clear in my mind before we even launched this project of how we were going to measure success. When you take ownership as a leader, it gives Bob permission to say, well, I should have come to you. I knew I wasn't being successful. And now you have workability.
Fascinating. I think we could carry on this conversation down so many pathways, and it's so important. I'm grateful for the work you do. Catherine Halpin, founder and CEO of Halpin Companies. I'm sure we'll circle back and have some other things to talk about, but I want to turn now to Mel Sanderson, co-chair of the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. What is the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations, and how did you get involved with the organization?
Thanks, Adrian. The Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations is, as we like to say, the leading foreign policy body in the Valley. And what that means in real life terms is we try to bring a more global awareness to people in the Valley. Our membership tends to be comprised of people who've either lived abroad or want to live abroad or perhaps have emigrated here. And In other words, people who are already interested in the world, and we're using that as our base to encourage others to become interested. But you know what, Adrian, I want to just say something that's on topic, but a little off the beaten path, because when you and Catherine were talking about hierarchies in business and how that hasn't changed in 100 years, you know, people love to stratify and separate. Anybody who's ever flown in an airplane knows how completely artificial frontiers, boundaries, state lines, national lines are. And businesses are doing the same things. So part of what we're about at PCFR is trying to break those boundaries and try to help people see that you may call yourself, you know, a Russian, or you may call yourself an American, but at the bottom line is we're humans. We have the same concerns, the same interests. And if we only give ourselves a chance to talk to each other, we might find that out.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to teach very popular classes at Berkeley that really exposed students to the artificiality of the modern nation state. It's the way we do it now, but we haven't been doing it this way for as long as folks might think. And as you say, when you're in the air looking down at this rock hurtling through space that we all live on, you don't see those lines. They're not actually in physical reality, but they are hugely significant in the lived experience of people once states get involved in policing borders and enforcing trade agreements and all the things that are in the news in a way that I think everyone should pay meaningful attention to. But we lose sight of the fact that there's a commonality we have as human beings, which underlies all of that. How did you personally find your way to that perspective? What's your backstory? How did you get involved with the Foreign Service and get to where you are today?
I like to say God is good because I don't believe in coincidence. But growing up in Cincinnati, Ohio, I had never heard of the Foreign Service or diplomats or any of that sort of work. But I had a driving, passionate urge to get out of Cincinnati, preferably to anywhere, but mostly I had a Star Trek vision. I wanted to boldly go where no woman had gone before. And because my father died, I did not come to Arizona to go to the Thunderbird School of Global Management, where I had a scholarship. Fortunately, I had another scholarship offer at home at Xavier University. So because of that chain of circumstances, I met one of my advisory professors there, who was a former Foreign Service officer. And it was Frank McVeigh who said to me in a sort of joking, challenging way, well, why don't you just take the Foreign Service exam? And I remember I literally said to him, is that thing where they ride camels in the desert? I thought
only some of them.
Exactly. And he was like, no, trust me, just take the test. And that was how that all began.
And what year did you join?
1985.
So that's a fascinating time. You had no idea at the time that you first took a role with the State Department that the entire world was going to change in 4 years. That everything you thought you knew about international relations was going to be upended in 1989, when all of a sudden, unbeknownst to anybody, the Soviet Empire crumbled. The Red Army withdrew from the satellite countries in Europe, and it was a totally different game. What was that like for you as a young Foreign Service officer, cum diplomat?
Refreshingly chaotic, because sometimes chaos is good.
Yes.
It also reinforced that concept of the artificiality of borders and separations. I mean, the Berlin Wall epitomized that more clearly than anything else. Where was I in 1989 is what you were about to say when that actually happened. In 1989, I was working for the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, Science, and Technology. And we were working on the second START treaty, the first supercomputer control regime, and the rewriting of the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty.
And you were based in Foggy Bottom, or you were working?
At that time, I was in Foggy Bottom, yes.
For the uninitiated, the neighborhood in Washington, D.C., where the State Department's headquarters is.
And appropriately named, many would say.
Although foggy heads sometimes prevail against the advice of seasoned diplomats. Where did you go in the 90s? That was a very tumultuous and unsettled time in American foreign policy. We engaged in many conflicts and in many peacekeeping missions that also had unintended consequences and certainly created the conditions for the world we're in now without realizing it. How did the 90s go for you?
It started out very smoothly. I started out in Canada in 1990. My mother was still with me at that time. And so we were still going to civilized places. And we followed Canada with Spain. And sadly, my mom passed away in Spain. So from Spain, I went to El Salvador to head the anti-narcotics program. And it's funny that you mentioned the unintended consequences, because part of what we were doing at that time was bringing back some of the gang members out of L.A. and depositing them in Central America. So indeed, unintended consequences.
Yes, when Chalmers Johnson wrote his book, Blowback, he did not foresee some of the ways in which the drug wars and things would take, and our relationship with dubious characters would become a source of discomfort and problems for us in later life.
Absolutely. I also went to Poland to take part in getting Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary into NATO, another game changer on the European checkerboard, which has led to unintended consequences with Russia.
When you moved here to Arizona in, did you say 2007?
2006.
The last place you had lived was the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Which I loved.
A beautiful country devastated by war, devastated by exploitative mining practices and other really nasty things that mostly don't make it into the news. What was it like for you transitioning back? And at what point did you get involved with this Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations and realize that this was something you could participate in that would, in a way, continue and extend your diplomatic career?
Oh, my Lord, I was shocked to move back here. When you're away from any place, whether it's your home country or not, for 20-some years, the place changes, but it hasn't changed in your mind. So I got back here, number one, to a state that I'd never lived in. And unlike Catherine, I arrived in June. So right into the frying pan.
Out of the humidity and into the fire.
Exactly. And I immediately was deeply dissatisfied, shall we say. But what I realized was I had spent my life adapting to circumstances that were infinitely harder than a heat wave in my own country. So I stumbled across the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations thanks to Doug Brunke at the Global Chamber, because Doug had found me and asked me to speak there, oddly enough, on a sort of human basis about the importance of cultural understanding for international business success. And Connie was there. Connie Angelina is the executive director of the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations and the central point between we three women today. And she was there. And as soon as I saw, you know, the words foreign relations, I finished speaking and went straight to the table. And that was it. I was sold on the first time I spoke to Connie.
Folks with international interest may be aware of the Council on Foreign Relations, which plays somewhat of a national role. I'm chagrined to say that despite my long internationalist and globalist credentials, I had no idea there was such a thing as the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. What are some of the activities of the group? What sort of programs and offerings do you have available?
You know, it's so frustrating because PCFR has existed for over 40 years. And we originally were an offshoot of the Council of Foreign Relations. It was an effort done by the CFR to basically spread the word to state levels by setting up ancillary organizations. And our activities are still very much like those of CFR. So we bring speakers to the Valley to address issues of moment, whether those are breaking topics, which we address normally through what we call topical lunches. Our topical lunches are held in downtown Phoenix. They're open to the public. There is a $25 admission fee, but you're going to be hearing from some expert on a subject that is happening now. We also host dinners, usually once a month for every 8 or 9 months of the year, because we don't do the dinners in the summertime. And again, those are focused on sort of more deep thought topics. So rather than today's explosion, it would deal more with, well, what are the long-term consequences for mass migration movements around the world? And we'll find someone who's competent to discuss those consequences, both economic and political, bring them in for a dinner session which of course is obviously a longer meeting. And then we have the question and answers which follow.
Many companies that operate globally, either because they have locations or partners in different places, are aware of and engaged with global risk management, political risk, economic risk, contracting with firms that provide open source intelligence and insight to help them make better decisions. And yet at the same time, you alluded a moment ago to the idea that many business leaders are looking for something utilitarian. They're looking for, how do I do business better? And it's almost this kind of cultural tips and tricks for conducting oneself and building relationships with people in other environments of other backgrounds. I think that's valid, by the way. It's necessary and maybe insufficient. So how do you help business owners in Arizona who might be aware of the need to deepen their international understanding and engagement to begin to learn and connect with the people and resources that will help them?
Well, we sadly, in my personal opinion, we are not in any way a sort of referral service, but we provide a lot of informal learning because our membership is composed of others like myself who are former Foreign Service or former intelligence community, former business persons, many of whom were CEOs or founders of their own companies. And so there's always the opportunity around any of our functions to interact with these members and form relationships. I mean, I've gone out to lunch or dinner with various people and conduct that sort of informal learning. And on a more formalized basis, I mean, part of our success has been bringing ambassadors to the Valley. We had the Chinese ambassador here. We've had the Mexican ambassador here. So we do offer businesses an opportunity to connect with the highest level of a country of interest to them and build that relationship as well.
I think that people who have not moved in some of these circles, and certainly in some of the countries that we've traveled in and worked in, might not realize the degree to which the diplomatic corps of other countries are exceedingly serious about their attempts to build relationships, and largely out of self-interest, as everyone is. I often share the story when I was living in Sudan. I was in Khartoum on a break. I had been working in Darfur for months. This was 2004, 2005. And I was, you know, kind of on a weekend away from the war. And I was in Khartoum. And I remember being in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel in Khartoum, overhearing a Chinese delegation meeting with some very high-level Sudanese government officials. And it struck me how very, very good the Arabic that the Chinese team spoke was. And I thought to myself, that right there tells you a lot about a much bigger story about China's involvement in Africa. But the fact that they have senior people and an entire team who are speaking a very difficult language that has obviously taken them years to master, they're so far ahead of us in some level in this game. The us in this is very, very lowercase u for me. I'm the opposite of whatever a nationalist is. But it was striking to me. And we don't see that level of commitment. I mean, in part by design. The nature of a Foreign Service career is not always to become a deep subject matter expert in one particular country or area in the world.
Well, there's actually two trains that you can follow. You can be a true generalist, which is what I chose to be, and I acquired many different job skills as well as many different languages and lived in many geographic spots. But you can also be a specialist. We have specialists in China. We have specialists in Saudi Arabia. We have specialists in Russia. So some of our more complicated but key relationships, if you show an aptitude for that, the service will encourage that aptitude. So you basically have a choice.
When you interact with business leaders, particularly here in our backyard, what are the common themes and questions that you find yourself and other folks at the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations fielding? What's on the mind of business leaders in the Valley with regard to international affairs today?
I think that there's a growing concern about anti-Americanism, because, you know, we Americans have profited greatly in the past from a business sense as well as a social sense from two very important things. And the first of those is the prevalence of the U.S. dollar as the currency of preference for international trade. And the second has been free trade agreements, which have opened our doors and forced other countries to open their doors. So given the more recent developments around a couple of those issues, there is a growing concern about a mounting anti-Americanism around the world. And you look at Africa just as one continental example. There's always been a pronounced preference for American partners. But the Chinese outspend us. The Chinese are more nimble. And so particularly now when many African nations worry about, well, what about if our tariff preferences are reduced or eliminated? How would we compete? It's another advantage for a country like China. So that's a concern for our business people.
This growing anti-American sentiment is certainly something in my own personal experience over more than a decade in the Middle East and Northern Africa. I certainly saw shifting. I mean, I can remember when I was first traveling and working as an archaeologist and as a field researcher doing social surveys and things in 1994 and 1996, and I spoke some Arabic then. It was not as good as it would become after more years of formal study and hiring tutors and engaging in the region with folks. But the general conversation I would have with every single taxi driver, not to pull a Tom Friedman here and say, well, everything I know comes from, I had a taxi driver, but I would talk to a lot of taxi drivers, all right, this is how you get around. And everybody would say, oh, you're American. Oh, you know, we hate your government's policies, but we love American people. And this was just the, you know, I'm caricaturing the conversation a little bit. It was more in depth than that. And it would go from there to things like our unquestioning support of the Israeli state and its relationship to the occupied Palestinian territories and people's personal experiences being displaced from their homes or growing up in Jordan, but being Palestinian, and lots of complexity around identity and things of that nature. I don't remember exactly when it was. I think it was actually before September 11, 2001. I might have been in the year 2000. Later that year, I was taking a taxi, and for the first time, I had a conversation with a Jordanian-Palestinian taxi driver. And it might have been after, it might have been 2002. In any case, this man said to me for the very first time something interesting. He goes, you know, your government really creates a lot of difficulties for us in this part of the world. And he said, you know, we like Americans, but he said, now tell me something. You vote and you elect these people, right? And I'm thinking to myself, well, I didn't vote for that guy, but yes, I mean, that is how we do it. That's our system. And he said, so really, it is your fault. And for the first time, I thought, you know, he's not wrong. We've kind of been getting away with something, saying, oh, well, that's the government, but we're just here as private citizens or affiliated with a research institution or a university. We've been getting a free pass. The conversations got a lot tougher as our involvement, particularly after the invasion of Iraq and some of our other entanglements in the region, became more vivid. We were being held to a very different standard as individuals. Well, if this is a democracy, or democratically organized republic, as my nerds would like to point out, and you elect these people, then aren't you responsible? And I didn't want to admit that the answer was yes. Changes the nature of the conversation. Clearly in Arizona, we have primary trade relationships with our neighbor to the south. Mexico is a very important business partner for imports and exports. And yet the political environment, which we won't delve into too extensively, often creates a lot of noise around some issues that the business community might wish we could find a way to get over so we could get on with doing business. What's the current state of conversations between Arizona businesses and the Mexican government, Mexican partners? Where are we at with that? That's not an area that I know anything about, so I'm interested to hear your perspective.
Well, isn't that fortunate, Adrian, because I happen to be on the board of the Arizona-Mexico Commission also, which just celebrated its 60th anniversary. Mexico is by far Arizona's largest trade partner. It exceeds the next closest trading partner by fourfold. Yes, and people don't generally know this, that is how tight this relationship is. The Mexican ambassador is very fond of citing the statistic, and it is a true statistic, that every minute, $1 million in commerce goes across that border. So it is unparalleled in the world. When you look at all of the U.S. border states and the Mexican border states, it equals an economy which is the fourth largest in the world. So Mexico matters. And Arizona's been very fortunate, in part because we've had the AMC. And it's a tribute to the AMC leadership that it just celebrated 60 years, because that's surviving in political vicissitudes on both sides of that border. That's a triumph by anybody's standards. And I would also say that particularly the city of Phoenix and the city of Tucson have been very robust in their international leadership and in their engagement with Mexico. The city of Phoenix has its own trade office open in the city of Mexico. It also has one in Sonora and Hermosillo. The state obviously has its offices also in Mexico City and in Hermosillo. So, you know, it was Governor Ducey who said last week that there's a lot of rhetoric and then there's what we're doing day to day. And I have to agree with that, because it's easy to get caught up in that rhetoric and think, as I said at the beginning, that the border is an insurmountable objection. But on a day-to-day basis, we're managing to stumble along remembering who we are and how much we need each other. So that's great for Arizona.
Noam Chomsky, who's something of a national treasure that some people don't like to embrace, recently spoke in Boston. He's an emeritus professor at MIT and also has a position at the University of Arizona. And he spoke about this exact phenomenon, the fact that, and this is, I think, true regardless of whichever party happens to hold positions of power, that there is a way in which the rhetoric is meant to appease one group of constituents and the policies are meant to appease another group of constituents. With regard to trade and business, the primary constituents involved in that are the business owners, the companies, the large corporations for whom these relationships are essential. And yet there's a lot of rhetoric that is not for them. It's aimed at a base intended to mobilize votes and play a political game of showmanship and media time and all those other things. They're both very serious. They're both very real. And yet at sometimes they are at cross purposes. In your experience, and I don't mean this to be a loaded question, I really want this to just be something sort of an honest look at this. Does the business community get nervous by some of the political grandstanding? Even when they might agree with some of the rhetoric and policy positions, it's unsettling because they have a more important commercial interest?
Absolutely. There's no such thing as empty rhetoric. Words matter, because words will be heard by human beings and they will be interpreted by human beings. This goes back to the rise of that anti-American sentiment that I was talking about earlier and which you so aptly followed up on, by pointing out that fundamentally each of us individually is responsible. It's not empty rhetoric. I used to say to people in foreign countries, because you're right, your experience in the Middle East, it's replicable all over the world. People in various countries, especially with governments that are not particularly democratic, always like to divorce themselves from that reality. Well, it's them. It's them.
It's the generals. It's the junta. It's the, yeah.
Exactly. And I would always say, you know what? They didn't fall from the sky. They're not Martians. They're not Venusians. They're you. And the same is true for us. And that's why, yes, businesses are concerned by that rhetoric, because it is having an impact. It, if nothing else, it confuses the bejeevers out of the world, because one day it's one thing and tomorrow it's another thing. Business can't do business in the domain of uncertainty. We need to know what's what.
Absolutely. Tina Kosumi, you are also on the board of directors at the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. You have an international background of your own that's taken you all over the place. How did you come to meet Mel and join the board, and what's your work like today?
Absolutely. I was born in Kosovo, the former Yugoslavia. I would say that I am a success story of what American intervention, when it is a success. Next month, it will be 20 years that my family immigrated to Arizona as part of a refugee resettlement program. I went to Arizona State University and University of Arizona, and then studied abroad in Italy, which put me on the path to work, not as a foreign service diplomat, but close enough as an intern at the U.S. Embassy in Rome in the political office for a period of time. I ended up in Arizona working in the private sector for the past 6 years in marketing and global expansion. And one of our general counsel at my previous employer told me about this person, Mel, in the Valley. and I like to consider myself as a founder of FOM, which is a group that's known to many people here as Friends of Mel. We almost needed Mel to come into the Valley to bring us all together. Mel and I sat down together. I was feeling pretty, well, I was traveling all over the world and doing international distribution. I didn't feel a sense of a foundation or didn't feel grounded. And I was feeling separated from all the foreign affairs and all of my education and corporate social responsibility, political science. And the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations became the answer to that. Mel and I had lunch together, and I quickly realized that I needed to become a part of this group. And when I decided to take time off to build my house and do some nonprofit volunteering, I chose the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations to really help revitalize the organization. And thanks to Mel's leadership, we have, Mel really wanted emerging leaders and young professionals to become a part of the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. And we have successfully done that in the past 3 years. Mm.
The mid-90s in your home country were certainly a time of extraordinary upheaval, conflict, and suffering. For those outside of the region, it was something they only saw remotely. You know, we were in an era where superpower dynamics had changed, one had evaporated, and the U.S. had taken on this role of humanitarian military interventions in these conflicts between non-state or state and non-state actors in a variety of places. That was not an intellectual or political exercise for your family. It was a very real reality. How did your experience and then your subsequent resettlement and then the career that you're able to have, how did that shape the way you view these issues today?
Being 12 and there being an intervention that as a teenager or as a kid, really, you it's very hard to understand. And I think it was very difficult for my family to come to terms with the fact that there was a mass exodus and we needed to leave Kosovo during the NATO bombings. And having grown up in, it is only now in my early 30s that I have come to really understand what growing up in a country that had complete separation between ethnicities really meant for my upbringing, where school was not available to Albanian children during the day. We went to school during nighttime. So for someone having grown up in those conditions and having immigrated here at such a young age, I had to create my own path in many ways. And that between choosing to study human rights and believing that corporations can be excellent corporate citizens and wanting to work in ethics and governance, those are all a product of how I was raised.
I'm having a moment here, even as you're talking, I'm feeling very moved, reflecting on some of my own experience, which I don't often talk about. And connecting what you just said, Tina, to what Mel said a few minutes ago about how rhetoric is real. Thinking about how little some people appreciate the way in which their inflammatory language creates conditions of extreme suffering for humans. You know, we said never again after Rwanda, and then we said never again in Darfur. And today we're seeing in many different countries, including our own, which is not something I ever thought I would be encountering, the conditions where young people are experiencing extraordinary disruption. And that's just such an inhuman way to say it. But if I get specific, I'll get really upset. We don't take seriously enough the ways in which some of our language habits and self-reinforcing beliefs, some of the things that, Catherine, you were addressing earlier, the natural human tendency to want to think the best of ourselves and the worst of others, when that gets played out in a geopolitical arena where it's not just a toxic workplace, it's a toxic world, the results are horrific for the people at the wrong end of the power spectrum in those situations. Another thread that I want to bring into this conversation, partly to get myself out of this emotional state I'm finding myself in unexpectedly, is this issue of mentoring. Tina, you spoke about how important your relationship was with Mel and the importance of mentoring for younger leaders. What's it been like for you to be taken under the wing, so to speak, if that's the right way to put it, and be mentored in the context of the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations?
Absolutely. I have relied heavily on mentors my entire life, and I have found that it's especially important for women to mentor women. For emerging leaders, diversity and inclusion that we were talking about earlier, it has become a necessity in today's workplace. But for established female leaders, that was not. They had to work a lot harder to get to where they were. So I think as an emerging leader and as a younger professional, I have to lean on leaders like Mel in order to help guide me, because otherwise, at times it can feel really disorienting being in the world of trade and government here in Arizona.
Can I just add something to that? Because I don't want to let this moment go by. Because Catherine also said earlier about mentoring being a two-way street. Well, I'm on this program today because Tina was willing to share an opportunity with me. Tina mentors up to me without even thinking about it. We are engaged in a mutual journey together, which I hope is equally enriching for us both.
And we share the love of hummingbirds and
yes.
sunsets.
Yes.
It's great, Mel, that you went there, because that's exactly where my brain was going. I wanted to ask Tina, we heard a little bit about what leaders need to do to adopt this mentoring role. And my follow-up question was, Tina, from your perspective, what do young professionals need to bring to the table and to the relationship to both seek out and then get the most value out of mentoring relationships?
Yes, being a millennial myself, an early millennial, and having had to deal with graduating around a recession, there's sometimes millennials, including myself, have had the attitude of, you know, we've been dealt really terrible cards and we're late in the game. And I've done this too, but I was speaking to my friend Nancy Schenker earlier today about this interview, and she called me out on it and said, hey, it's time for millennials to take some responsibility. And that's the one thing that we're doing at the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. One thing that I've noticed is that from my peers in my age group, not many of them are involved in civic engagement. There's this idea of, oh, I'll get there someday, but we are at that age. We are at the age where we are taking on leadership positions. And it's really important for my age group to kind of stand up and take the stage now, because while established leaders have paved the way for us, at some point they will leave their leadership positions, and we will see that a lot more.
Yes, absolutely. With only a couple minutes left in our conversation, Tina, I would be remiss if I didn't follow up and ask you a question about one specific area of your expertise, which is corporate social responsibility, ethics, and things of that nature. You have spoken and continue to work on helping companies localize their community involvement. In the context of a conversation that's focused very much on internationalizing things, our awareness, our relationships, and so on, you also think it's important to maintain a local connection, to localize supply chains, to keep tax dollars in Arizona, to support organizations like Arizona Local First. Can you speak about this dimension of your work and your commitment?
Yeah, absolutely. While I was doing my graduate school thesis work at Arizona State University, this was right after the recession, where corporations had become this evil. And I wanted to fight that, because as corporations have citizenship just like we do, and I really believe that by engaging the private sector and corporations in developing robust corporate social responsibility pillars, everyone would win. And 10 years later, there is a 6-8% stock benefit to companies performing better that do have strong ethics and governance programs. And I believe, especially as Arizona is becoming, the Phoenix Valley is becoming a headquarter or HQ2 kind of place, a lot of companies have really large, massive presences here, but they don't do that much in the community. Their employees are kind of siloed in the different suburbs, maybe live in those areas and are not very engaged in what's going on in the arts and arts and culture. And I believe that by building robust corporate social responsibility pillars, having community engagement positions open, the kind of community engagement roles that I have been looking for that don't exist very much, companies can really help their employees feel a sense of place and belonging where they live and where they work.
Catherine Halpin, you've been working on issues related to community engagement, the arts, in addition to business, for a long time. You're, in my view anyway, and I say this with utmost respect, a kind of matriarch of the Valley in certain dimensions, certain aspects. What's it like for you to listen to some of the conversation playing out here, the generational differences and things? What are some of your observations as we close the conversation?
Well, it gives me tremendous joy to hear these comments from such a young person. When I moved here in 1992, people really didn't give to the Phoenix Symphony. They didn't really give to the Phoenix Art Museum. They gave to the Cincinnati Art Museum or the, you know, Chicago Symphony, because everybody was from someplace else and their ties were still there. So we've come a long, long way, and it's so exciting because I grew up in a small town. You know, my great-grandfather had been the city attorney. My grandfather had owned, you know, businesses there. We were six generations going to the same Catholic church. We knew the value of being involved in our community. That was just the way that we were raised. And then going to Dallas, such an establishment city, you know, and when I lived there in the 90s, 80s and 90s, I served on a board of a nonprofit when I was like 26 years old. That's unheard of, but it was just like just expected in Dallas. Everybody will get involved. Everybody will contribute. And so coming here was quite a bit of a culture shock in 1992, but I'm so overjoyed.
There's certainly a sense, and as a relatively recent transplant here, I came with my wife, Jen, and I think it's 6 years now. There's certainly a sense, at least for this observing anthropologist, of an emerging sense of connective tissue.
Yes.
That's very exciting to witness. I feel we're very early in some regards in our maturity, both as human beings as well as an ecosystem of business and culture. But it's great to be part of something that is taking shape, and not always in ways that I would agree with, but that give us opportunities to engage and to participate. Catherine Halpin from the Halpin Companies, where do people learn more about you and connect with the work that you do?
Well, our website is www.halpincompany.com, H-A-L-P as in Peter, I-N. And I'm all over social media too, Facebook and LinkedIn.
That's wonderful. Thank you for joining us in the studio today.
No, thank you, Adrian.
Mel Sanderson and Tina Kosumi from the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. Mel, where do people go to learn more about the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations, participate in the programs, come to the dinners when they resume in the fall?
www.pcfraz.org. And we have a topical lunch coming up next week and topical lunch also in August. So the lunches don't sleep, only the dinners.
Tina, we'll give you the last word in this conversation. What is something that you are most inspired by, and what do you want others to do in terms of either connecting with you or connecting with causes here in the Valley?
I would say I'm really excited about the work that we're doing at the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. We are rebranding our organization, and I've done rebrands in the past, and it's really exciting self-exploratory work. And we will have an event, a big event coming up that I invite many of you to join.
Marvelous. Tina Kosumi, Mel Sanderson, Catherine Halpin, thank you for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you, Adrian.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.